iFaith 73, My Kingdom or His? We'll be talking about the theme of kingdom, kingship, who's king in our lives. In today's offering, which comes from Judges 6, 7, and 8, God's people initially were led by Moses, a single figure, and then by his successor, whom Moses raised up, Joshua. But in the period of the Judges, where we've been looking currently, it's not so neat. There's no single leader. And even when there is a leader, that leader doesn't lead all of Israel. Now, they will get a single leader, although not as God would have preferred, when Saul becomes king. And that's in 1 Samuel. You have Saul, David, Solomon, and you have those various kings. But in between the time of Joshua and the time where there are kings, the period of Judges is very chaotic. Also very colorful. Probably my favorite stories would be Ehud, the left-handed fellow who rescues Israel. Deborah, for sure, whom we looked at last time. There's Jephthah and the complicated issue of human sacrifice. Samson, the juvenile delinquent whom God uses. Certainly Gideon, where we'll be today. On this, just one more introductory comment. On the thought of kingship, four times at the end of Judges, we read a comment that goes like this. In those days, there was no king. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. And there's a double meaning here. It's not just that there wasn't a king and there would be a king, but unfortunately, God was not king. And as the situation is portrayed as disintegrating, I think that's exactly what's happening. Oh, this is a very low time for God's people. We pick it up in chapter 6, verse 1. The Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord, and for 7 years he gave them into the hands of the Midianites. Because the power of Midian was so oppressive, the Israelites prepared shelters for themselves in mountain clefts, caves, and strongholds. Midian so impoverished the Israelites, they cried out to the Lord for help. This is a difficult time. We read that the foreigners were destroying the fields, shutting down, limiting agriculture. They're forcing the Israelites out of their homes. It must have felt like the Midianites were very powerful. Where was the power of God here? Is Midian more powerful? I mean, they're hiding and living wherever they can in caves and strongholds. This is a desperate situation. God sends a prophet to the people. I'm summarizing because there's just too many chapters to read the whole thing. But God sends a prophet to the people who challenges them that if they'd been faithful, this probably wouldn't have happened. And then God sends an angel to Gideon. And we have a serious or humorous interaction. Perhaps it's both. Let's read. The Lord is with you, mighty warrior. Now, Gideon, pardon me, Lord, but if the Lord is with us, why has all this happened to us? Where are all his wonders that our ancestors told us about when they said, did not the Lord bring us up out of Egypt? But now the Lord has abandoned us and given us into the hands of Midian. Gideon doesn't seem like a likely choice for a leader here. He's full of negativity. I'm sure he would say he's being realistic. But notice how he is addressed. He's addressed mighty warrior. Let's continue. The Lord turned to him and said, go in the strength you have and save Israel out of Midian's hand. Am I not sending you? Pardon me, Lord, Gideon replied, but how can I save Israel? My clan is the weakest Manasseh, and I'm the least in my family. And the Lord answered, I will be with you, and you will strike down all the Midianites. And Gideon replied, if now I have found favor in your eyes, give me a sign that it is really you talking to me. Well, this is a call scene. This is a commission. This is a scene we see many times in the Bible when God asks men and women to step up and to let him use them. And in most of those, I think, for example, of Jeremiah's call in Jeremiah 1, Jeremiah says, I'm just too young. Moses famously making excuses. You can find a lot more of those. But Gideon makes out that he's a nobody. He's weak, he's small, he's uninfluential. But it's not really totally true. Gideon's family are clearly prominent. They have, as we'll see, servants, lots of servants. there is a shrine, a little temple on their own property. They worship on their property. His father is important. Well, we'll come back to that in a moment, how God uses him. But notice those words, go in the strength you have. And that's something I've been feeling a lot lately. And I don't mean I've been hearing an audible voice in my head, but those words have stuck with me, haunted me these last few weeks as I've been working on this particular talk, that there are things I can do, even if the situation is not ideal. I know something, I can do something, I've learned something. And the point is to step out in faith, to go ahead. When we have faith to go in the strength that we have, God will be with us. We have to do it together. Gideon, however, wanted to double check that he wasn't just imagining all this, that perhaps it wasn't God speaking to him. He wants to make sure it's really Yahweh. There is an internal dialogue in his head, just like there's often an internal dialogue in my head. I think of a good idea, and I think, well, maybe not, or not now, or maybe that's not a good idea, or I'm not the one. Sometimes it actually can get quite noisy with all my thoughts. But Gideon is, he's willing, but there's a condition here. He needs a sign. Well, that same night, the Lord said to him, by the way, God gives him a sign. We're skipping over that part. That same night, the Lord said to him, take the full-grown bull from your father's herd, the seven-year-old, tear down your father's altar to Baal, and cut down the Asherah pole beside it. Okay, now, he's given a commission to destroy an altar to Baal, like the chief god in Canaan. He's basically the god who controls weather and agriculture and fruitfulness. And then it mentions the Asherah pole. Well, Baal was the son of El. El was like the most high god, and Asherah was his consort, like his wife. But then Baal displaces El, and so Asherah becomes the consort of Baal. Kind of like 1 Corinthians 5:1, a man has his father's wife. But if you're looking to the Canaanite gods for morality and a good example, you won't find it. So he tells him to take a bull and tear down the altar and the pole, and then tells him to build a stone altar to the Lord your God on top of this height. Using the wood of the Asherah pole you cut down, offer the bull as a burnt offering. There's firewood. So Gideon took 10 of his servants and did as the Lord told him. But because he was afraid of his family and the townspeople, he did it at night rather than in the daytime. In the morning, when the people of the town got up, there was Baal's altar demolished with the Asherah pole beside it cut down and the second bull sacrificed on the newly built altar. There comes a point when we must take a stand, and Gideon does that here. We may feel alone. There may be fear. He does this at night. Surely his faith could have been stronger, but he was a person of faith. In fact, he's commended in Hebrews 11:32, in case you wonder. He is a man of faith. But he has to take a stand with his family, something that all Christians must be willing to do, as Jesus reminds us in Matthew 10. The family of Gideon had been playing it safe. They'd been worshiping Yahweh and Baal, or maybe both together in some kind of fusion. The townspeople want to kill Gideon, but his father comes to the rescue. His father defends him, which is really good because this shrine to Baal was on his father's land. The father reasons with the people, and he's rescued. Now, we might think that by now Gideon has sufficient confidence, given that he'd successfully torn down the altar, he'd had one sign, the angel goes up in a fire of flame, and then he asks for two more signs next, which he gets, and after that he overhears a dream in the enemy camp indicating that he will be successful. This guy needed a lot of assurance, and maybe you relate. Now, all the Midianites, Amalekites, and the other eastern peoples joined forces and crossed over the Jordan and camped in the valley of Jezreel. The Spirit of the Lord came on Gideon. He blew a trumpet. He sent messengers, calling them to arms. There's a coalition of Canaanite forces, and Gideon summons the Israelites by blowing a trumpet, and it said that the Spirit of God came on him. The Spirit of God comes on a number of people, many people in the Old Testament. They're not receiving the indwelling promised Holy Spirit. That's part of the new covenant. But the Spirit comes on different people, and they do great things. And next the Lord is going to make it abundantly clear that he's the one in charge, because he has Gideon cut his army down from tens of thousands down to just 300. An army of 300 facing 135,000 Midianites. And there's a most unusual battle plan. They don't attack the enemy. It'd be difficult to do that with just 300, but they spook them. And the 300 hold clay jars and torches, and I guess they have their weapons as well, and trumpets. And so they surround the camp, and by breaking the jars and then the lights becoming visible, and they make the sound, Midian does not know what's happening. Now, anyway, watch, Gideon told them, follow my lead. When I get to the edge of the camp, do exactly as I do. When I and all who are with me blow our trumpets, then from all around the camp, blow yours and shout for the Lord and for Gideon. There's the battle plan. Notice he says they should follow the Lord and him. It's for the Lord and for Gideon. Well, the plan works. When the 300 trumpets sounded, the Lord caused the men throughout the camp to turn on each other with their swords. This is psychological warfare. So much of the battle is really in our heads. Here, the Midianites don't know who to trust, and they're fearful, even though they massively outnumber the enemy, Israel. Their army flees. The Israelites pursue them. Gideon triumphs, and there's peace for 40 years. But in chapter 8, the Israelites come to Gideon, and they say this, rule over us, your son, your grandson, because you have saved us from the hand of Midian. They're asking him to be a king, to set up a dynasty, that is, his son and his lineage would rule. Well, that's not going to happen. He's from Manasseh. God's plan is the king would be from Judah. Anyway, but that's later. But so Gideon tells him, I will not rule over you. He says the right thing. Nor will my son rule over you. The Lord will rule over you. And then he says in the next verse, I do have one request, that each of you give me an earring from your share of the plunder. And so everyone brings gold, and Gideon makes the gold into an ephod, some kind of sacred object which he places in his town, Ophrah. And all Israel prostituted themselves by worshiping it there, and it became a snare to Gideon and his family. Yeah, he'd been doing okay so far, but what's up with this gold object? It was either something that you wore, or it was an implement for divination, maybe both. Now, Gideon is not a king. He says the right thing. He acknowledges that the one true king is the Lord. And Gideon humbly passes into private life, staying in his small town rather than relocating to the much more important town of Shechem. But in some respects, Gideon lived like a king. Think of this. He's described in these chapters, read them later if you need to, as having a regal stature. He carries himself like royalty, and so do his brothers. He has special jewelry and clothing, the ephod. The family is able to offer a bull, which shows that they're very wealthy, they have all these servants. He has many wives. He has the harem. He has 70 sons, we read. And one of his sons, who was actually not by it was not legitimate son, that was Abimelech. Abimelech means my father is king. And then when Gideon dies, there's this succession argument. Who takes over? Who's the next one? And his son Abimelech grabs the kingdom. So it actually seems that he was living like a king. Or was he? It seems he's double-minded. And in that, I can relate, because sometimes when it comes to whether God's the king or I'm the king, I get confused. Maybe we all do. We want to do great things by faith, but not forget the one who enables us to do them. And Psalm 18 would be great follow-on reading. Well, let's close with some thoughts on how to follow the Lord as king, to make him our king. First, obviously, we have to obey him. No excuses, but go in the strength that we have. Second, he knows that we need assurance, that we can't do without his help. So let's go in the awareness of his presence, in the awareness of his spirit. And if we do well and people congratulate us, it's okay to accept praise. If they're supportive, be grateful. But watch out for agendas. Be alert. Not all positive words are spiritually helpful. We need to steer people towards the king, because we're building for him, not for us or our family or our congregation or our church group. So let's never forget that God's kingship is unlike any earthly human rule. That king, the Lord, wore a crown of thorns. King of my life, I crown thee now. Thine shall the glory be, lest I forget thy thorn-crowned brow. lead me to Calvary. And so the story of Gideon makes me consider my life and ask, is it my kingdom or his? Next will be in the book of Ruth. Thank you for listening.